Welcome back to episode 203 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we love to pursue the glories of ratings gain, but we often dive into the plateaus and sometimes below that, the pits of despair. Hopefully that's not you. If you want to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys. I want to thank our queen level supporters, Tim Everett, Scott D4B6 Joe, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Don Rich Burgess, Brandon Hallside, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrigan, Rich Bradley, Fenner, Fletcher Ray, Nathan Peterson, Christian Glaw, Andrew Rimmer, Trevor Mocha, Mohammed Ibrahim, Ian Mason, Adam, Will P, Kenny Gray, Matthew Siebert, Mark Yazerball, and King Level supporters, Ian Samples and David Clark. If you want to appear on the show, a great way to do it is to fill out the show notes, fill out the Google form in the show notes. I want to hear your story. And if you're interested in getting better at chess, I feel like you are. Noel Studer has his next level training program. There's a code in the show notes that will help you get the best deal you can. And my YouTube series, The Road to 2200, is going better. It's no longer The Road to 1800. We are making positive moves, so that's great news. My Chessable course is out, the Chess Journeys Tactics Workbook, Turning Knowledge into Skill. Comes with a money-back guarantee, so you might as well try it if you haven't yet. And lastly, we have a sponsor for the show, Chessnut. They make a variety of awesome electronic chess sets. I have one just to my left. It's summer break. I've been using it extensively. It's a great way to get over the board games in when you can't get over the board games in. And of course, you can use the code KevinSkull for a discount. Okay, so this week we've got Matthew. He's a 21-year-old college student at the University of Florida. He's looking to improve his chess. He's made a lot of improvement in a very short amount of time. Matthew, welcome to the show, and have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
I have. I have played 4 Blitz games on chess.com earlier today.
Okay, and what is your time control when you play Blitz?
I tend to play 3-0 when I play online.
Okay, because it replicates over the board play?
Absolutely, it does not replicate over the board play. In fact, I refuse to play no increment or no delay over the board blitz.
Okay, so why do you play 3-0 over the inner? Is it just because that's like the standard time control?
Yeah, I feel like it's standard time control, and I've experimented with playing 5-0 or 5-3 or something of that nature, but I generally feel like the pool of players in the 3-0 pool is stronger than some of the other time controls. That's been my experience.
Okay, interesting. I personally do 3-2 because I don't mind when someone flags, but I don't want it to be like, okay, they have mate in 3, but yes, I ran them out of time. Like, I feel weird about that. So if you got a mate in 3, you get to do the mate in 3 on me.
That's fair.
And is that how you spend most of your time online with chess, or do you play other time controls online?
Generally, when I'm trying to improve, work on most specifically the middle game, the end game, I try to play longer time controls, 10-0 or 15-10, because when you play 3-0, generally you're playing the end game at light speed, and playing those slower time controls give you time to actually think in those end games versus just playing as fast as possible.
Okay. Do you find that Blitz helps you with your opening work?
I feel like it's a good measurement of if your openings are working, because I feel like you tend to, if you know the opening better, you tend to have a time advantage and tend to perform better. So the more I feel like I know of the opening, it will be shown in the results.
Okay, so you're using it less to like train your openings and more as like a way to evaluate where you're at with your openings?
Exactly. I feel like that's the case, especially with something newer I'm trying, like playing different lines in the Rosalimo, finding something that works, like particularly with the black pieces, getting very playable positions.
Okay, that sounds good. Let's talk about you and when you picked up chess. I mean, you're only 21, so in my mind you're still kind of a kid, but you're not like a kid, right? You're not like the 8-year-old I sit down. But if someone said, like, did you play a kid today, I'd be like, I don't know, kind of in between, I wasn't sure, unless you told me your age. So when did you pick up chess?
I picked up chess my freshman year of college.
Oh, okay.
Just So I never played Scholastic chess. I've only played chess as an adult, which I mean, saying 18 years old, technically an adult, maybe some gray areas with what people consider adult chess. But yeah, I all I knew at that time was ladder mate and scholars mate. And from there, just continue trying to learn YouTube videos, trial and error.
Okay. Well, what got you into chess then if you hadn't played at all?
Being bored one day, pulled up chess.com. Won a couple games with scholars mate and it stopped working, and then been learning ever since.
Okay, that's funny. And then, like, how did you even learn about chess.com? Has chess just become enough of our public consciousness that everyone knows what chess.com is?
I would generally assume that people are familiar, the majority of people are familiar with either chess.com, the chess, or one of the two. And if they wanted to play online chess, if you just search a chess, one of those will be in the first page of results.
Okay, fair enough. And when you defeated people with scholars mate, I'm sure you felt great about yourself. You're like, yes, I'm awesome at this game. And then you started losing. What were your steps? Were you like, oh no, I got to go deep into this? Or is it just kind of like, I'm just going to like dabble with chess and, you know, have a good time?
Well, whenever you don't know how to do something, first thing, or at least for me, the first thing you do is you pull up YouTube and you search whatever it is you're trying to figure out. And that's precisely what I did. And it just slowly evolved from there. And now I'm a couple years down the rabbit hole and playing tournaments and all that.
Okay. And was your first hit Gotham Chess, or did you start somewhere else?
I do believe it was Gotham Chess in the Caro Kann, which I abandoned very quickly as I learned that I'm a player who very much enjoys space, and having to endure the advanced variation of the Caro Kann is black. I did not enjoy, so I tried to play things where I could fight for more space.
Yeah, I will say this. I don't understand why every person who plays white does not play the advanced variation. All the other variations are no problem. It's the advanced variation where you're like, wow, I have to really know what I'm doing here as black, and it is hard.
Yeah, you kind of have to find a fine line, but I even stopped playing the advanced variation as white because I found I'm a player who doesn't like playing with lock centers. I like open lines. I like space, and I want to be able to enjoy those advantages. So I've since moved on from it as white as well.
Okay. Do you play the exchange variation?
I play the Panoff, so I guess that does fall under the exchange variation. So
you play the crazy version of the exchange variation.
Oh, yeah. I like it to be a little wild and crazy. It gets sharp, which is fun, especially when you know more than your opponent. Then it gets really fun.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like the Panov probably the one I see the least of. So that does seem like a good variation to pick, especially if it's going to be sharp. There's a chance you know more. Yeah, that does sound like a good idea.
Kind of a surprise weapon. I have some friends who are above 2000 who play the Caro Kann with black, and they say they never see it. So figure at any level, it can be a useful surprise weapon.
I agree. I think the surprise weapon I see most often is the fantasy variation, but I always surprise them. And they're like, whoa, I'm out of theory really fast, and this person knows a lot of theory. What is happening?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's so many playable lines against the Caro Kann, I find. I mean, you can play knight c3, knight d2, e5, f3, the exchange, and play bishop d3. You can exchange and play c4. There's so many things you can do against it.
Yeah, there is a lot. Even within the advanced variation, there's all kinds of variations. So it can be hard being a Caro Kann player sometimes.
I can imagine. I feel like I'm part of the problem there. I'd like to think that, but you know, some higher level players definitely get out of the weeds very easily and flip the tables on me. So I've had it happen both ways.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm curious, as a tournament chess player, do you feel like your a kid at these tournaments, or do you feel like the kids are the kids and you're like a full-on adult dealing with the kids? I'm curious, like, where you situate yourself.
I kind of feel like I'm right in the middle. If I had to pick a side, I'm probably on the adult side. It is, and it's probably a different demographic being in Florida. Population of Florida is probably on average a little bit older. Okay. So maybe if I were to be playing tournaments, I have played one tournament out of the state of Florida. I played in DC once, and I definitely would have said I was much older than the median there versus being in Florida. I'm right around that point.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So do you guys just have less scholastic players, or are you saying the age of the adult is much higher?
Definitely the age of the adults. One is a lot higher, and two, I feel like there's a lot more adults into chess. People retire, they have more time for chess, and they get back into it. It's a frequent story you hear. People retire, move to Florida, get back into chess, and get back into the tournament scene down there.
Yeah, I would love to move to Florida and the retirement chess scene. It sounds great. My parents live in one of those retirement villages where there's like five chess clubs and they have chess every day. Sounds awesome.
Oh man, what a time that would be. Yeah. Play all day long, every day of the week.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, us in the real world, we have real commitments.
Yeah. Thankfully, summer break as a teacher is like, I get to live the life of a retired person for a couple months a year. I do have little children, right? So I still have that I'm juggling, but it's like, I have a couple hours a day to study. And I'm like, oh my goodness, it's amazing.
Oh, that's gotta be the best part of the year. Sit down, spend a couple hours a day on it.
Exactly. As much as I love teaching and my students, I mean, having a couple hours a day to do chess, nothing beats that. Okay. Absolutely. Well, your story is a really interesting one. As I was reading through, I was like, wow, this sounds so much like my chess story. In early 20s, I went from 1,000 to 1,700 in a year and a half. And it sounds like this is exactly what you have done. So I have a lot of questions about it. The first one is like, what do you feel like propelled you so quickly through this rise? Do you think it was just like your natural rating is around this spot, and it took you a little while to get up to that? Were there specific things you were studying that you feel like really propelled you forward? Like, what do you credit with all this progress?
Specific things I'm studying, which I feel like have helped, I'll touch on it, but other things, I feel like finding how to play over the board versus playing online. Once I figured out that that is a completely different animal, it kind of changed how I approach. Yeah, you play in 3-0 blitz, you just flag people, whatever. Mm-hmm. People are half paying attention, playing games on the toilet. They're hanging rooks on E1 every time you turn around. And that just doesn't happen when someone's at the board and they're not on their phone and they're focusing and they have double or triple or 10 times the amount of time, whatever. Yeah. Time control online, figuring that out quickly probably helped me to improve. I play very much wild and crazy online and sacrificing pieces and all that, and I would never go for such variations playing over the board rated games.
Okay, wait, I gotta ask about this. So you feel like even your style changes based on like expectations of opponent's skill and focus?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if I, in a 3-minute blitz game, have the opportunity to sacrifice a knight for 2 pawns and create a pass pawn, I will do it 9 times out of 10. Over the board, I would hardly ever consider it sacrificing material for such a different advantage, which is probably not always the best. Probably sometimes it is better to go for a spec or a sacrifice, which could be a little bit speculative, but gives some considerable advantage. So I feel like I have a very different style when I play online versus when I play over the board.
That's very interesting. So you're more materialistic over the board. You want to, you know, keep 100%. That material even. Does it change your opening choices at all, or is it just like how you play them?
No, I play the I play the same repertoire online over the board, and although it does go through a lot of changes very frequently, I'm always looking for new lines if I find something isn't working. But getting into middle games and end games, I play a lot more defensive, and I frequently find myself over the board drawing from positions of strength against players higher and lower rated.
Okay, so you feel like you're getting advantages, but then maybe this sort of fear to take big chances makes it a little bit harder to capitalize on the advantages?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I could see that. It is harder, I agree, to pull the trigger on a really speculative sacrifice where the difference to me is not that they focus more, but it's if you're wrong, you then have to suffer with the consequences for an hour. Where you're just like, hour, you're like, what am I even doing? Why did I do that? Yeah, that part.
If not longer.
Yeah. Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. So you sort of change a bit. Let's go through like that first period where you went from like 1,000 to 1,300 quite fast. Was that just like tactics? Were you in playing, or were you actually studying things that you talked about YouTube? What were you working on?
I mean, I feel that I've played thousands and thousands, probably close to 15,000 online games. And I feel like simply seeing more patterns between the start of playing over the board chess and playing, I think it was my third tournament. So I happened to play a quad where I was under 1,000. All of my opponents were above 1,200. I happened to win all three games, and I gained a ridiculous number of points for that. So
yeah,
I feel like that really helped propel me closer to 1,300. I mean, it was just one event, and I think seeing all these additional patterns online and then being able to apply it over the board caused such a spike.
Okay, so you feel like for yourself, a volume of games lets you internalize patterns. Do you feel like when you see a pattern once in a game and you just, boom, you've got it? Or do you like study that pattern and drill that pattern? Like, how does that work for you?
I particularly like to drill patterns I see in over the board games, especially in openings like the Panoff that are sharp.
Okay.
People and understanding thematic pawn breaks, I feel like, has been extremely important for that. So kind of lost my train of thought in terms of what the question was.
But yeah, so it sounds like you're focusing partially, at least, on plans of like, in this opening, I know these are the pawn breaks. Is this pawn break available this game? And what will the impact be? Stuff like that.
Exactly. And the same thing for my opponent's pawn breaks, understanding, is it beneficial to take? Is it beneficial to leave it? Is it beneficial to overprotect in some sense? What should the critical response be to a potential exchange?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big breakthroughs for players is when, and I went through the same thing, right? Where it was like, okay, these pawns are touching, or these pawns, like I could play, say, C5 here, right? To like do this break. Do I do it? Is it the right time? What if my opponent plays C3 and backs up that? Like, how does all this work? When you get to that level, I feel like it's that next leveling up, right? Of understanding how, especially if you like the Karo Kann, you have less space. If you never break out, you lose, right? So you need to know your pawn breaks and where they are and when to do them. Okay. And then are you saying also you're drilling like motifs in the openings you play?
Oh, very much so. And okay, heavily utilizing Chessable for that.
Ah, okay. So how do you use Chessable then? Is it memorizing moves in the opening? Is it focusing on like some really important ones and like pushing them to the top of the queue somehow?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I use it for trying to memorize the vast amount of opening theory. I made the decision to play very complicated theoretical openings, Spanish, the Sveshnikov Sicilian, with both colors, and just inc- incredibly dense theoretical opening. So I feel like that's important. But I also, if there's ever some line in a course I don't understand, I'll take that, I'll put it into the engine, look at some of the moves, look at some of the alternatives, and try to really understand the patterns that way.
Okay. So it's not just pure memorization. It's understanding patterns and why it works so that when it comes to memorizing, it's easier to embed because you have understanding with the memorization.
Exactly. So you have to, I mean, sure, you could play the move and you know it's the right move, but it's useful to understand the purpose of it, I feel like. So I spend a lot of time not only trying to memorize, but trying to understand. I feel like those two go hand in hand, particularly in the opening.
I totally agree. And I like to say I understand all my openings so well. And then my opponent will play the advanced Karokan. And I'm like, yeah, no, I get this. I've studied this. And then they make one move that's weird. And I go, oh, yeah, I guess I don't understand anything about this opening. Like I thought I did. But now I don't think I do. And then my opponent will be like, I actually don't either. And then we just flounder around in the advance for a while. Yeah, that's just normal.
That happens. Everyone gets out of book and then it's time to play chess once the memorization battle's over. And I feel like even you see that at super GM level, that the first move out of opening preparation when they spend 10 to 40 minutes out of the opening, it's first move a lot more often than you'd think is a mistake.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm curious, what do you think of, say, like Chess 960 at all? Have you tried that at all? Speaking of memorization battles, do you not like the memorization battle? Are you like, no, man, I'm 21. I love the memorization battle. Let's do this.
Yes, I love the memorization battle. I consider that my strong suit. I have not really even delved into the 960 world. I've played a couple games in it, and I simply, it's like I've forgotten how the pieces move. Just the patterns that appear in the standard position, I feel like there's a whole new set of patterns with 960 in every single position that it's difficult to apply them sometimes.
Yeah, I'm very curious if like playing a bunch of 960 would help my chess or hurt my chess, right? And one way I think it would make you more creative, more thoughtful about how every piece moves in every position. But like you said, I feel like a lot of chess is just building patterns. And if you're building pattern recognitions for patterns that don't appear in regular chess, like is there overlap there? I'm really not sure.
I did read an interesting article on Lee Chess about that, about variance as a whole. And it said everything but 960 is detrimental to your chess, and 960 on average only hurts you a little. So it's better than any other variant, but
oh I'm sorry, variant. I thought you were saying like studying hurts your chess play.
Oh no, sorry variants.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay, so it only hurts your chess a little. I could see that.
I don't recall what the exact numbers were in terms of supposed rating loss, but generally that's what I recall reading, is that if you're going to play a variant, 960 is the best.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like if you mostly trained on duck chess, it would be very weird playing regular chess.
Atomic chess, everyone's favorite variant, where you get to blow 3x3 quadrants of the board up. And
that seems like good training. I did play a 960 game the other day, and it was interesting. I've only played like two in my life. And it was a very weird, interesting chess game. And I was like, I could feel how this could stretch me as a chess player, but at the same time, I'm not sure it would be the best training tool. So, oh well. Okay, so you get to like 1300, you're just playing a lot, you're drilling your openings. Is that still what's propelling you even farther from there? Or do you start adopting some new study techniques?
Yeah, I mean, I still admittedly spend the majority of my chess study time on openings, which is very against the conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
And I I'm someone who likes to be, I feel comfortable knowing I've been in prep longer than my opponent. I enjoy having that time advantage that typically comes with that. But as I've gotten to a point where I feel pretty safe, I'm not going to lose out of the opening, that I start working a lot more with end games, studying master games, exposing myself to some more deep kind of deeper into the game and seeing what's important, good decision making, practical play, things of that nature that are very important in over the board chess.
Okay. And these are things you're going to start doing now that you've hit 1700, or you've already started doing these?
These are things I've already started this Christmas. Growing up, I was someone who, oh, I hated getting books, and now I ask for chess books for my birthday and Christmas.
Okay.
So
Do you
my
actually
parents.
read them, or you just put them in a stack like I do and say, like, I think about them?
I mean, it's I take them up to school with me, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna spend X number of hours a day or X number of hours a week, and it never happens. But then I come home and I'm on summer break, as you are, and I get to bust them out, spend some time with them. So Jeremy Silman's Endgame Manual sitting right
Okay.
there next to me is
Good one.
going to get some attention over the next few weeks.
Okay, nice. I wasn't being fair to myself. I've only stacked up half the books I've read. I have read half of them or so. I just finished Positional Decision Making in Chess by Boris Gelfand. I did a review video of it, and that was a really good book. And I'm kind of in a book hole right now where I'm like, I don't really know what to read. Everything after this book seems bad now. And I'm like, ah, that book was too good. It's ruined me for other books. I don't know. Sorry.
I have heard good things about that one, and that is, I have my list of what I want that's about 20 books long, so that's on the list to acquire. But I had a couple plane rides recently, and I had the Woodpecker Method.
Okay.
I'm not going to attempt to, well, Axel Smith and Hans Kekkonen. I probably butchered that, my apologies, but that's one. It's not necessarily reading, it's mostly just a puzzle book, but that's one I've been working through recently, which is, I found it to be excellent.
Yeah, me too. I think that's a great book. Are you planning to do the Woodpecker Method, or are you just going through and solving all the puzzles?
I'm, as of right now, just going through and doing the puzzles. If I feel as though I get a block of time sufficient to complete a cycle of the Woodpecker Method, I will pick out a set and go through it. Did you go through it doing the traditional woodpecker method,
Haven't
or?
done the method yet. This is the funny thing. Everyone who has not done the Woodpecker method, I always hear criticism like, oh, it's not worth doing. But every single person I've met who's done it on any puzzle set is like, it changed everything. I gained 300 rating points. And I'm like, why don't I just do it? And the reason I don't do it is it's hard. Like, it's a huge commitment.
Oh yeah, it's a absolutely massive time commitment to go through and do. Towards the end, you're doing whatever the entirety of them in a single day. It's like, wow, really have to.
8 hours of puzzles. And my theory is just this: if you and I just did 8 hours of puzzles every like couple months in a day, we'd get a lot better at chess. Like, that's just, I'm not sure
Probably
it
so.
matters if you do the Woodpecker method. Just 8 hours of puzzles will probably do it.
Yeah, the tactical sharpness would skyrocket. Maybe that's the spaced repetition that Chessable prides itself on.
Exactly.
Maybe that's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
I try to do that with Jeremy Silman's Endgame book. I go back and do the chapters I've already completed every 6 months, so
Yeah, good idea.
hopefully I retain that.
Yeah, I do something similar with that book. I think it's a very well done book because it's divided up by the rating level, and you can really get targeted advice for you.
Yeah, it really deepens based on what you kind of need to know.
Yeah, exactly.
And that I've found to be beneficial.
Okay, so you're a younger guy. We're not going to say you're a kid. You're not a kid, right? Like, but you're a younger guy. And the theory, or at least the like stereotype, is that your age is really good with like technology. There's AI on the horizon. Have you been able to harness these in any way to help your studies? I know for myself, just the other day, I put into AI like, hey, I want to see some good Rubenstein games with annotations. You know, can you do them for me? And it was like, sure. And it did its own annotations. And I was like, that's not what I meant. I wanted like actual good annotations. So I have to read them. Maybe the AI's annotations are going to be great. I'm not sure.
Maybe so. I don't know. Hopefully my professors don't listen to this. I have utilized it for school, all the AI, which has been incredibly useful, particularly for brainstorming when applying something like that to chess.
Yeah.
Maybe if you consider engines AI, I, against the advice of many, virtually always have the engine on and running.
Okay.
And I feel like that helps me understand why my ideas are wrong. But doing your own self-analysis, I do some self-analysis in on moves that aren't covered in opening books or opening courses.
Okay. But so you're generally a fan of examining your games with AI so that you get that instant feedback of like, this is where I'm going well and this is where I'm struggling.
I absolutely am. And maybe it's, you just need the instant dopamine hit of seeing the instant gratification of what the exact answer is. But I try to go through and annotate my games once before I turn on the engine. Mm-hmm. All my tournament games, I like to spend hours with each one over a period of 2-3 weeks. And I mean, what I see versus what a computer sees, it's night and day. And
yeah,
but I still feel like training my brain to scrutinize my own play is useful.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying for classical games where you put a lot of time into the game itself, it's worth it for you to put a lot of time into the analysis and do a pass of just yourself and then use the computer. But when it's like a rapid game or a blitz game or your own opening analysis, you just use the computer.
Oh, yeah. I use the computer for anything non-classical games, analyzing my own openings. Just before we got on, I was working on my Panov and I'm just running lines through the computer just to see what it says.
Okay. Nice. There's this AI tool. Now I can't remember the name of it. The person was on Perpetual Chess a couple of weeks, like Nocturnal, something like this. And the claim was like, you can play a bot and it will give you like instant analysis as you're going. And what's interesting about that is I've always thought that that was such a good way to learn at least other things I've done. So like I used to play a lot of competitive card games, and my friend, I didn't even know at the time, he was the world champion of the game when I first met him, right? And so we would play these games, and every move he would just be like, that was bad for this reason. And not surprisingly, I got really good really fast with the best player in the world's instant feedback. And so I don't know, there's a little part of me that's like, maybe that is the way to train, is to play with high-level bots that can give you really good feedback immediately and be like, that move was bad for this reason. You could be like, oh, now I see that. Thank you. I don't know. I don't know if that would be good or not. But then on the other side, I'm like, I don't know. That's just, it feels like maybe it's bad training, because then when you're in a game, you're kind of relying on that. Come on, come on. Come on, bot. Is this good? Whoa, where's my bot? I really needed to know.
Where's my instant feedback?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess you could kind of get conditioned to that, but I feel like in the same vein, I believe I was reading this in Josh Waitzkin's subject of Searching for Bobby Fischer, the film. I read his book, The Art of Learning, and I feel like he talks about playing against his coach and getting that feedback did help him. And maybe now that we have technology, maybe you just don't need another person anymore. It's kind of the same idea.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Because I've been feeling like that's the one thing missing from my training, is to be able to play with a really strong player who can just give you that really terrible instant feedback. Like, everything you're doing is wrong. Some people wilt under that. I think I would really appreciate that. I think that would really help to just be like, okay, cool. Now I know that's wrong. That's wrong. So everything I do is wrong. Okay, thank you. Then then I'll just not be wrong every time anymore. This is great.
Yeah. I mean, there's a finite number of legal moves in a given position. If you're told one is wrong, that gets you one move closer towards the right answer. So I
Exactly.
guess so.
Okay.
But I was gonna say, I feel like I have the same experience playing with stronger players. Being at such a large school like the University of Florida, there's a number of NMs and
Oh, that's cool.
they're all incredibly strong, and of course multiple players between 2000, 2200 US, and I mean they just beat up on me, and I'm appreciative for every second of it.
That's cool. Are these in like chess clubs or just you got to know them and now you just hang out?
And no, it's mostly through the school chess club, and then Kevin Pryor, the president of the Federation, runs a Wednesday night quick rated event every week. So sometimes some of them show up there and I get to play them, and it's incredibly valuable to have that. So
Yeah, I found the best way to get better at chess is to play people better than you. That's just it.
yeah.
Can't match that.
Of course.
Okay, so that's pretty great. So you're able to play with people better than you on a regular basis. How do you feel about tournaments? It feels like you've had quite a bit of success. Do you really enjoy playing in tournaments? Do you find them to be challenging? Like, what are your thoughts on tournaments? Are they worth going to?
Yeah, no, I very much enjoy playing tournament chess. I love playing long games, 90 minute, 120 minute games. The thing is, I'm not a big fan of sleeping in hotels. So the meal schedule of tournaments and the sleeping schedule of tournaments is always very difficult.
Yes, I would agree. And also the choices of meals can be very challenging. If you only have 40 minutes or something, and it's like, all right, there's two restaurants in the hotel. You want to eat there?
Yeah. Do we have time to run to Chick-fil-A or something like that? It's also a consideration. Are you willing to sacrifice a quarter of your clock time to go eat something somewhere outside the hotel?
Yeah, people are like, "Oh, showed up late. You were prepping for me, huh?" And you're like, "No, I was eating Chick-fil-A." I'm like, "Oh, okay. All right. I didn't realize that."
No, I have sat in many a Chick-fil-A's and prep for my opponents. Sometimes you do both at
Both at the
once.
same time. Okay, that works. My daughter was at a chess tournament like last weekend, and this little kid, the round had started. And somebody was like, "Hey, what are you doing? The game's already started. Go in there." And he goes, No, I'm good." And she's like, Are you playing this round?" He's like, "Yeah." It's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I'm making him wait. It's a mind thing." I was like, "Oh man, this
Oh
little
man.
7-year-old is already getting into the mind games."
Oh,
Oh
when the kids start using
boy.
psychological tricks, it's over
Yeah.
for all of us over the age of 18.
There we
I
go.
did. I have done something similar once. I have a copy of Fabiano Caruana's
Ooh.
Roy Lopez right here, which I was reading through earlier. And I was playing in a tournament, and I knew my opponent in the next round. I had white. And I knew he played e5,
Okay.
so I was thinking, I'm like, I can sit there and read my book with the cover very, very pronounced, so that he could see I was preparing.
That's
Sure
funny.
enough, he didn't play e5. He played the Caro Kann, and I won that game. So I feel like, oh man, is it worse that kids are using psychological tricks on us, or that we're using psychological tricks on the kids? Maybe not weird. I am using psychological tricks on the kids.
That's funny. Well, I mean, there's lots of levels, right? With the little kids, you could like line up a whole string of chocolate bars and just very slowly eat them. I feel like that would be kind of cruel, you know, like a lot of kids wouldn't be able to handle that one. And then you like reach out like you're gonna give it to them, and then you pull it back and eat it, and they're like,
Oh, I can only imagine that would be torturous for a young child. You
I haven't done that myself. I'm just saying, I've heard of this.
Oh, that's something someone's actually done. Oh, that's unbelievable.
I mean, people do everything, right? Like, you never know.
Yeah, you always hear stories of people getting kicked under the table
Oh
and.
yeah. One of my favorites was there was this guy. He was just enormous, towering over the board, and I was like, how is he so tall sitting? Like, this guy must be like 8 feet tall. And I looked, and he had stacked three chairs on top of each other so he could have like this giant throne and like be towering over his opponent. And I was like, I hope this is for a health reason and not a psychological reason. I don't know. I'm not judging.
That's a hilarious one. I might have to try that.
Yeah, yeah. It seems great. And then your opponent sees that and they stack five up and they're like, oh yeah. That could have like a chair battle.
I've heard of the inverse. I've heard of little kids who will push the chair away and kneel on the floor and be only this high above the board.
Okay.
And they try to like shrink away, like they're making their moves mysterious, and they keep their eyes low so you can't see what they're looking at or something. I've seen it go both ways in that regard.
I've seen almost everything with kids, but I don't think I've seen that one. I think kids do more mental warfare than any group of people I know. Like the aggressive cough, where you're like, before the game, they don't have a cough. After the game, they don't have a cough. But during the game, they're like projectile coughing at you to try to see if it rattles you. And there's just a lot of things they do where you're like, okay, all right.
Make all kinds of noises. I had a kid one time, he would click his tongue. Just the entire time it was my turn, he'd stop doing it on his turn. Then it would be my turn and start doing it again.
Yes, there are a lot of things that little kids do. Not all little kids like that, though. No. Lots of wonderful little children who play chess. I play them regularly. But yeah, it seems like at the big tournaments is when that comes out. And I can't tell if it's because like they feel more pressure that they need to perform, and so they're willing to do that. I don't really know what's going on. Maybe it's just nervous.
Also see another thing that seems to spike at those tournaments with kids. Draw. Every move, your turn, their turn, doesn't matter. I get offered so many draws by kids. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a parental thing, if they don't want to lose and like disappoint their parents or something, or they don't want to lose themselves, or they just want the game to be over because they don't really care. But I get offered so many draws at big tournaments.
Oh yeah, I hear you. It's a regular thing. What annoys me is when it's like, I don't mind if you want to offer me a draw. That's your right. But if I decline it, the next move is probably not the time to offer again. If you want to wait 10 moves and then see, sure. But not every move for 14 straight moves. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, that happens. And it's not when they make the move off of the draw and hit the clock. It's like 2 minutes into your turn. Draw? Like, what?
Yeah, okay. That would be annoying. I actually have... Oh, that's right. I forgot about this. So at my last tournament, I was playing a kid, very good kid, much better than I was, but I had a great position. And it was going to be hard, but it was clear. He had an isolated pawn. I've got everything piled on it. He's desperately trying to defend it. I'm clearly the one pushing. He offers like five draws. And finally, he's like, sir, are you sure? Are you sure you don't just want a draw? And I'm like... And that time I was a little bit rude, and I was like, no, there'll be no draws. And he was like, okay. And then here's the worst part. He went on to win. And I was like, son of a...
Oh, no.
Yeah, worst feeling ever.
Walks away from the board, should have taken the draw.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, no, I should not have. Put it in the engine. You'll see. I just messed it up. I'm clearly winning there. Okay. Well, I saw that you played in the amateur team South. These amateur team tournaments are super fun. I played in one. Let me tell you my story first, and then we'll hear yours, because mine is very short. I was the worst player on a loaded team. So it was like they were all 2000s, and then they wanted to play in the under 1800 section. So they just picked the lowest rated person at the club, which was me, and I was the sacrificial lamb. And I went 0-5 or 0-4. We got first place, and I lost every game, and I got a trophy. And I was like, I got a trophy for losing every game. All right, if you say so. I feel like your experience was different than mine.
Oh, that's interesting that y'all had sections. We did not have sections. It was one section. And we went as a school. We had an A team and a B team. And actually, in the second round, we had to play each other.
Oh.
How did that how did that work out? But yeah, I won against a 400. I won against a 1900. I drew a 1900. Hey. I beat an 1100, and then I beat a 1700. By far the best tournament performance of my life, it felt like. And I mean, I had black in that game I drew. I was minus five, minus six multiple times. And it was one of those, I had a queen for three pieces. It was incredibly complicated. So yeah. I can't be too upset. And I was down over 40 minutes at one point during that game. So, but Amateur Team South, I agree. It was a really fun event. And I also got a trophy.
Ooh. Right here.
This was not a trophy for best board four. That is second place college. I believe there were only three college teams, and University of Florida A team got first place, and University of Florida B team got second place. So that was
nice.
That was a nice trophy. But yeah, I believe as a team we went 2.5 out of 5. I don't want to say I was getting fed sacrificial lambs, but
yeah.
Because I did pull several upsets.
Yeah, but you were just awesome.
Yeah, but board one has to play a 2150, and I'm playing someone who's between 1900 and 400. It was a lot of variance in terms of my opponent's strength on board four.
Yeah, did you like the team aspect? Like, did your teammates support you? Was it like an actual team, or was it more like four independent people playing?
Yeah, no, it very much was a team aspect in terms of we did have a captain. Our board one was the captain, and being able to look at your teammates' positions, discuss with your captain whether it's okay to take a draw in a given position.
Yeah,
but I felt like that was kind of cool to see what you should try to be doing versus what your teammates are doing on the boards to your left or right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. On that team I was on, I'd be like, hey guys, it looks like I might lose. And they're like, yeah, I know. We expect you to lose all your games. I'm like, okay, thanks for the help.
Thanks for the help. No, it was very much a different situation. I was sitting here winning, and most of my teammates were struggling. So it was, come on guys, I'm holding down the anchor. I need you guys in the lead to start pulling away a little bit. We gotta work on that. But it was a fun experience being able to play, and you're in the room and I'm playing my game on board four, and the next table over is Women's Grandmaster, International Master. And it's cool because being below 2000, you're not often rubbing elbows with those who are playing on board one of an entire tournament.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Wow. Well, that sounds really fun. Playing tournament chess in Florida, have you run across a friend of the show, Omar Mills, yet?
I do believe I've seen the name on some rating reports. I don't believe I've met him. No.
Okay. All right. Well, if you get a chance and you see him, you know, say hi. You guys are both former guests of the show. So you're part of the family.
All right. Omar Mills, I'll have made note of that. We'll have to see if I run across him at some point.
Hopefully he's okay that I said his last name. I've always called him Omar. So hopefully we're good there. All right. I'm curious, having made all this progress, I'm just going to tell you how I was thinking when I was in your boat. I was like, the sky is the limit. I feel like if I want to be IM, I can be, but it's a big want. Like, it's a big, arduous journey. At that time, I kind of had a decision to make. Do I go back to graduate school and try to juggle chess? Because I was doing it pretty hard. I was teaching and playing. Or not. And I had a really bad tournament, and I had a great tournament where my performance rating was 2450, and I was like, yep, see, I told you I could be IM. But then the next tournament, oh my goodness, it was the US Open. I went like 1.5 out of 9 or something, because I played in the, like, it was just insane. And it just crushed me. And I was like, you know what, Kevin? I don't think you have it in you for this I Am journey, actually. Let's just say we did well and move on with our lives. So I took that.
Oh man, I have heard similar stories of people going playing the US Open and losing hundreds of points.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it's a very strong field, and there must be pockets of the country where there aren't many high rated players, and people like as a closed pool are underrated, and they come to the US Open just rip people apart. So it's probably the case, but I don't think my goals with chess are as lofty. I've always kind of had the sense that starting 5 days before my 19th birthday, that such a lofty goal is very unlikely. The long-term goal right now is 2200 USCF. So
that's a very solid goal. That sounds, you know, doable if you are willing to make the sacrifices and put in the time. What do you think? Do you think you will be willing to make the sacrifices and put in the time?
Oh, that's a really good question. Depends on, because I'm probably not going to do it within the next year. So depends on what, when I have to get out of college and get one of those JOB things that, you know, all adults or most adults have to do.
Yeah.
What kind of commitment will I be able to put into it outside of working hours? So
yeah,
it's a sacrifice I would like to make if given the time. If not given the time, it's gonna probably lead to some serious stagnation, which is another fear. I haven't lost rating in a tournament my last like 10 tournaments or something to that tune. So
I don't want to say we all hate you.
Terribly right afraid of such a.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive stuff.
Well, I mean, going from 966 to 1703 without losing rating, I probably wouldn't be able to replicate that again for the next 700 points, if at all possible. So I know there's going to be some volatility and some stagnation, but that's kind of the current goal of my study, is avoiding stagnation, continuing to make progress, and hopefully I can continue to see the climb and not take a visit to the rating floor. That's not something I want to endure.
Yeah, ratings are all fun when they're going up. It's when they start roller coastering that you're like, this is really hard. Like, if I have much of my self-worth tied into this, it's going to be very challenging. As one day your rating goes up and then the next day it's down, you're like, I feel good, I feel bad, I don't know how to feel. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be an emotional roller coaster of seeing it climb and fall and climb and fall in a cyclical way and not making consistent progress. I will likely experience that at some point. So
maybe not. Maybe you'll one of them be the lucky few who never experiences it. Ooh, I just hit refresh. You ready for the roller coaster ride? At the National Open in Vegas, I had the worst tournament I've had in a long time. I lost 50 points. It was a terrible tournament. But in my club championship that just concluded last night, I had to take two byes in the first two rounds. A week ago, I beat a 1900. Last night, I beat a 1923, performance rating of 2323. And I gained, let's see, I gained 62 rating points. So we're coming back. We're coming back.
Congratulations on such a result. Wow. Well done.
That's pretty good for me.
Higher rated players than I've ever beat. I think my highest draw is 1924 and my highest win is 1895. So those are two incredible results.
Yeah, I was quite excited. And tied for third in the club championship. And this is the wild thing. There's an under 1800 prize. All three of us, the people who tied for first and me, are all under 1800. We all like had all these upsets, the high rated players, like what is even happening right now? So I don't know what's going on. Ratings are everywhere. So what are you going to do?
You know, okay. Points are always getting passed back and forth. So
yeah, that's for sure. I'm curious, what's your next tournament? Do you have a big one on the docket? I know every Wednesday you're playing some rapid ones. What's your next big classical event?
I'm considering playing sometime over the next couple months while I'm off school. I believe there's a tournament down south of me in Estero, Florida that's coming up. I'm considering if I want to play in that, but if not, my next tournament will likely be the Florida State Open, which is, I believe, the last weekend of August, which also runs into the 1st of September. So
okay. Has college started yet then?
Yeah, that will be probably the second week of school for me. Gotcha. But yeah, I went to the state championship last year and played in the under 1400 section, did incredibly well. I think I scored 4.5 out of 6.
Nice.
And this year, now I have to consider, do I want to play up, or do I want to play in my section? And I don't know. I played up in my last tournament and not really sure how I feel about that experience. It was incredibly difficult. Okay. 5 incredibly difficult games.
Yeah. So do you prefer playing in your section or playing up? For myself, like, it's something you reflected on earlier. You said, you know, playing with people better than you is such a good learning opportunity that whenever I have that, I try to take it, because at my own club, I can't, you know, sort of manipulate who I'm going to play. One week it's an 1100 kid, the next week it's an 1800, and it's all over the place. Whereas at these big tournaments, I can kind of guarantee I'm going to play someone better than me if I want.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I struggle to beat these high rated players, like high 1800s, low 1900s. I can get a crushing position, engine gives +4,
mm-hmm.
but I, based on my more conservative play style, like I said earlier, drawing from positions of strength, that happened 3 times at the my last tournament, which was incredibly disappointing. But with 3 draws and 2 losses, somehow still gaining rating points was unbelievable. So
yeah, that's when you know you're playing better people, right?
Yeah. And I mean, they were so incredibly resilient. I'd like to think I'm a resourceful player. I can find ideas to try to save positions, and the things that my opponents were coming up with blew me away.
Yeah, that's what I found is a big difference at that level. They tend to make egregious blunders way less frequently, and they're incredibly resilient. You're like, there's no move here that saves them. They're like, what about this? And you're like, okay, fine, that helps. But then what about this move? And they're like, I don't know, I got another one. And you're like, what? How many like amazing out of nowhere saves are you going to find here?
How do they keep coming up with the resources? It's like you have to beat them like 4 or 5 different times, is the analogy I've heard. It's like you get these advantages and you have these certain moments where you only have one move to not let it slip. Can you find that 5, 6, 7 different times throughout the course of a game? It's incredibly difficult to do.
Yeah, they never, I shouldn't say never, because they're only 1900, right? Which is crazy to say. But it feels to me when I'm playing them, I'm like, there's only one possible move. Every other move that looks good is wrong, and they always find the move. And I'm like, son of a, could just one time you be like, oh, I missed it? And the answer is no, they don't miss it. So I don't know. I can't even imagine what it's like to play Masters on a weekly basis. Like, what are they doing then?
Oh, no, that's the scariest part. I have some friends who are around 2180, and they're trying to get to 2200. And
oh, yeah.
It's their tournaments. It's International Master, FIDE Master, 2000, FIDE Master, 2200. It's like the players they're having to face are incredible. I can't imagine doing that 5 rounds in a tournament.
Yeah, that's like when I was thinking, like, I think I could be IM, thinking about what that tournament would have to look like to become IM. It means you're like beating a few GMs, and you're like, maybe not. Maybe IM is not realistic, actually.
No, and it seems like these master level players are so immortal, and then you turn on the engine, it turns out they're not so immortal. And frequently, I've played a couple master players, and the resources they allow are, to my eyes, unfindable. So that's something I need to work on.
I can agree with that. So, speaking of like unfindable resources and working, have you worked with a coach yet to help you train some of these things? Or are you still fully independent of coaching?
I am still fully independent of coaching. I've never had a lesson. I've one or two times asked one of my higher rated friends to come sit down and look through one of my games with me, but I have hope. I have a friend who goes to UF. His name is Vincent. He's over 2200, and he has never had a coach. He's entirely an entirely self-taught master. And that gives me hope that I could do it, but then probably slow down the process. One of the most amazing things about playing, he played Board One on UFA team in Amateur Team South. Kid can open up a copy of Modern Chess Openings, MCO, flip through the pages, find any idea, and he'll go, "Oh, I'll play this idea." And he just goes and beats a 2000 with it. It's just unbelievable how he can look at any idea and understand it and just play it in the game.
Wow, that is remarkable. I will say, when I was on your journey, going up 1700 point or 700 points in a very short amount of time, I also didn't have a coach. I was like, why do I need a coach? I never lose rating. Like, obviously it's going great. This time around, I have a coach. I will say though, I like you had a friend, National Master Craig Clawitter today. He wasn't a master then. He's now my daughter's coach. He's a great coach, but like when we were young, he was like the young kid. He was like 16 and I was an old man. I was like 23. And he would give me some help. So
That's very nice, and I have a friend who's an IM who kind of will do that for me as well, because he plays in this Wednesday night. It's just a 3 rounds, 20 minutes with a 5 second delay, and every time I get a chance to play him, he'll spend some time with me after the game, because the game typically doesn't go very long. And he'll go through and say, "Okay, so this was kind of your first error from the opening. I would encourage you to investigate this alternative," and then point out some other key moments in the game where he thought I could have had resources to fight on a little better than I did. So that kind of thing I find to be very helpful.
Yeah, that's cool. It's nice to have someone, even if it's not a coach, just someone who's higher than you, who can give you that human feedback that, engines are great, but they can't always talk to us how we need to be talked to.
Yes, that is very true. I've had that experience many times. Looking at some certain move, I remember I had a game at that tournament I mentioned earlier. I played up in DC, and there was one move. It was, "Okay, you need to sacrifice your bishop and let your opponent's queen infiltrate your second rank to try to trade a bishop for a knight. Your pieces look not active and their pieces look active, and it's the only move that provides you any advantage." And it's just an unbelievable kind of line to read through, and I still go back look at it every once in a while, and I show it to one of these various masters or 2000 plus players. I'm like, "Yeah, it's obvious. It's the only idea you have." And I don't know. Maybe
Interesting.
one day I'll reach that level of understanding, but that day is not today.
That's one of the things I liked best about that book I mentioned earlier, Positional Decision Making in Chess, is he kind of makes clear that he feels like there's a lot of lines the engine gives that, sure, they're objectively right, but they are just out of the reach of human practical play over the board in a 90-minute game, right? Like, yeah, you give me 3 weeks of analysis and I might come up with this, but you're like, you got 14 minutes for this move, go. The odds I find that move are zero. And I just thought that was really helpful to hear from him, that I can give me myself that grace when the engine says you missed this impossible four move combination. I can just kind of be like, cool, engine, you're better than me. I acknowledge that. Well done. I can't find that yet. Maybe someday.
Maybe someday, but again, not today. That there's always those kinds of lines where you have this random move your queen one square to attack a piece, and somehow positionally it's just crushing.
Yep. And you know, those moves are the most mind-boggling. I mean, the engine's like, do this plus four. And you're like, what? What do you mean, do this so I win a piece? No, you don't win a piece. It's really good.
No, it forces your opponent to move a pawn, which weakens a square, which you have to reroute a knight, five different moves to reach that square, and it's a good knight on that square. It's that kind of thing that just practically, that's such a long, drawn-out plan that it's hard to put into practice.
For sure. Well, Matthew, it's been a lot of fun. It's great to hear somebody who's having this tremendous success on their journey. I remember those days fondly. I hope you continue. I hope the next 700 points come as quickly as the last one. That means you'll be a FIDE master when we talk to you in a year and a half from now. It's going to be great.
Well, I would love to return with such a success story someday, but until then I will keep working and hopefully avoid the dreaded stagnation or the dreaded losses. So thank you so much for having me.
Where can people get a hold of you if they want to follow up? Can they get a hold of you on chess.com or anything?
I play on both chess.com and leechess.org. Username Matthew S0499. I have Instagram, probably. And I really don't want to give away my last name. Sorry if
it's fine. Okay, cool. Awesome. So that's a good place to get a hold of Matthew on LeeChess or chess.com. And for those of you out there listening, I hope this is the week where you have a great tournament and you gain 60 points beating 1900s like I did. If not, that's okay. That's all right. Come back next week. We'll have another guest for you, have some more advice. So have a good one, everybody. Goodbye.